In yesterday's San Francisco Chronicle, there was a story on the front cover that caught my attention. It was about a movement that has begun in the United States and has grown over the last several years. And the movement is called No One Dies Alone. It's volunteer. It's in community hospitals as well as for-profit hospitals, and started in Oregon and has moved. It's for those who are in hospital and who are close to death, who have no family nearby, no relatives or friends that are immediately able to be present. And so volunteers sit with people at their bedside, holding their hand as they die. They are offered training. They are instructed that often as someone is dying, their hands or their feet grow cold, that often their breathing becomes labored. And they are asked some specific things not to do. I suppose depending upon the demographic, they're asked not to knit or to text. Two very different things. But the idea is that they simply are present with that person. This is a very counterintuitive idea in our culture that is largely afraid of death and shunts it to the side as much as possible, that someone would volunteer to be present. And the thing is, they can't do anything to stop this person from dying, right? They can't ease the pain. The suffering may still happen. All they can do is to be present. Be present with that person in that suffering, to really be with them, opening themselves up to that person all the way up and to the end. In the first half of the 20th century, there lived a remarkable theologian who doesn't get as much publicity as folks like Karl Barth say. Her name was Simone Weil. She was French. She grew up Jewish in Paris and was a remarkable philosopher. Both she and her brother were child prodigies. She grew up and she earned her doctorate from the University of Paris in philosophy. But unlike some philosophers of the time, both, well, then and now, she chose not to live behind her books in the ivory tower. And so, in order to find out really where people of her day were, she decided to go to be with them. So, how many here have read or heard of the book Nickel and Dime by Barbara Ehrenreich? Okay. So, about 10 years ago, Barbara Ehrenreich, a journalist, went across the country and took on a number of minimum wage jobs as a hotel maid, as a cocktail, or as a waitress in a diner, all these different ways to see how people who are earning minimum wage get by, if they do get by. Well, this is what Simone Weil did, but in the 1930s. She actually went to a factory in France to see what the movement to make things cheaper and more readily available did to the human beings who worked in the factories. Does this sound familiar to anybody? So what she found there was startling to her and very troubling. And so as she came to meditate and write about it for the rest of her life, she talked about a concept that in English is translated as affliction. An affliction is a kind of a suffering that is something that deforms a person. This kind of suffering is not just physical suffering, but also social suffering. It involves isolation. It involves distance, so much distance from other people as to involve almost the loss of personhood. Simone Weil wrote that no one chooses this kind of affliction, this kind of suffering, that it is imposed upon people. And that when you experience it, all that you're able to do is to endure it. She also wrote about what it's like to be with another person in this kind of suffering. And the word that she used was decreation, right? It's a very Christian concept of emptying oneself in order to fully be present with another human being. This kind of attention is what she writes a lot about. Attention is not, it's not like concentrating, right? Like when you're concentrating on a task and you're really focused on that task, it's more like the suspension of ego, the letting go of self, so that when you let go of the space that Simone Weil talked about, the center of yourself, when you let go of that space, another person is allowed to enter in. What's important about this is this letting go of this space is not about an end goal. It's not about what you will achieve or what you will do. It's not about any kind of a gain. It's a gift whose only intent is giving. One way of talking about it that people have used is like when you go into a museum and there is beautiful art all around you, and you walk into the space slowly, allowing the pure beauty to penetrate you. All you do is get ready to receive. It's about being quiet. It's about listening. It's not something you have to create, but it's something that moves into you. This is what is being offered by those who volunteer with No One Dies Alone. People who are absolutely present, emptied of self, open to another. Compassion. Anybody who walks up Cedar Street sees the banner outside All Souls that says compassion. And hopefully as they walk by or drive by, it's one of the things they associate with the life of this parish. Now, compassion, of course, is not unique to Christianity. It's a tenet of all the major faith traditions. Many secular people and organizations follow this as a way of life. What I would say is that it is impossible to be a disciple, a follower of Christ, and to not practice compassion. It was all through little Abner's reading this morning. All of these ways to practice being with another. And compassion itself is a very, it's a wonderful word. The word, the second half, passion, it's Latin, means to suffer. The first part of the word, calm, with or together. Simply put, to suffer with someone, to suffer together. This is the heart of this practice that we have here. Compassion. Being open to another in their pain, and compassion meaning that no one need suffer alone. Leave it to Peter to be, from one week to the next, rock to stumbling block. In last week's gospel, he has hit one of his high points, right? And when Jesus asks, "Who do you say that I am?" Peter is able to come to this remarkable statement of faith. He says, "You are the Messiah," in other versions, the Christ, right? The Son of God. And to that, Jesus responds, "You are the rock, and upon this foundation will build the church." And this is all well and good. And so you figure with Peter, things are going well, they've got to take a turn for the worse. So in the next verse, really, just after that verse in the gospel, when Jesus proclaims this about Peter's faith, Jesus starts talking about suffering and what it means to be the Messiah, what it means to be turned over to the religious authorities, to undergo suffering, to be killed, and to be raised on the third day. Peter's response is what I think many of our responses would be. I know it would be my response. That can't happen. I've been waiting my whole life for this person to follow, and here you are, and now you're going to tell me that you have to die, that you have to suffer? No one wants their friends, their family, their loved ones to suffer. And so Peter actually takes it one step further, almost to blasphemy. God forbid it that this should happen. Jesus' response is just as fierce and even sharper. Get behind me, Satan. Do not be a stumbling block to me. You're setting your eyes on things that are human, not on those that are divine. What Jesus is saying to Peter is it's not that suffering won't happen. It's not that everything will go forward without pain. Being close to God does not mean that suffering ceases. Being close to God does not mean that suffering ceases. What it means is that God enters into the suffering to be with you, and that redemption is possible. He says to Peter, you are following me into this suffering, and that I will be with you in the midst of it all, even to the end. In this suffering, you do not suffer alone. So what do we do with this? As I walk around in Berkeley and this neighborhood, and it's easy once I put on my lenses of what I'm looking for to see where people are suffering. Often it's in the hollow, the hollowness of the voice, the hollow in someone's eye. In all around us, among our families, in our neighbors, there is a sense of loss, whether it's a loss of home, job, hope. It's in the sibling that we cannot stand. It's in a homeless person who, for all intents and purposes, might as well be a rock on the sidewalk the way people walk around. Every time I experience that kind of affliction, that kind of suffering, my response is the same. How can I keep what is pure and undefiled away from the muck of life, right? No one wants the touch of affliction. You know what Jesus' answer is? We don't. We aren't separated from the suffering. In fact, what we do when we see it in another is enter into it. What we do is we show up. Often this is hard, right? Isn't that why we have social safety nets? Isn't that why we give money to the organizations? But really what's asked of us is to show up. This is what losing one's life, what losing oneself can be. Right? It can be quite literal. You give up one's life to suffer for another, that's martyrdom. And it still happens in this world. Here in Berkeley, we may not be giving up our physical life, but the giving up of one's life to enter another person's suffering is what's asked. It's done by paying attention, because when you actually completely pay attention to another person, especially in their suffering, you give them the room to be human again. And they do not suffer alone. For no one dies alone, that means that you can simply hold someone's hand right? Volunteers do this. Family does this. Friends do this every day, where you hold someone's hand, even if you don't know that they're conscious, even if you're not quite sure that they know you're there. You hold that person's hand, and you do not let go. What might this be? Who might this be? What we're asked to do is to be there, to be present, to lose our lives, to lose ourselves, because in the process, we will be found in another.